Welcome back to a brand new episode of the MMA Reporters. It is Wednesday, July 10th, 2019. I, of course, am Ariel Helwani in New York City. Got a great show planned for all of you, and it's an interesting time, of course, coming off of UFC 239. The International Fight Week curse is no more. That's the most exciting thing to happen this past weekend. Last 4 years going into this year, something bad happened right before the International Fight Week card. UFC 189, Aldo pulls out. UFC 200, Jones out. UFC 213, Nunes out. UFC 226, Holloway out. This year, nothing. Amazing. And what a card it was. Plenty to discuss. John Jones, Amanda Nunes, Masvidal Askren. There's a lot there. So we'll talk about all that and, of course, the news of the week. And we'll also look ahead to the UFC's return to Sacramento. And, in fact, I'm very excited about this because in around 45 minutes or so, we're going to be joined by a man named Carmichael Dave. Now, if you're a casual MMA fan, you probably have not heard of Carmichael Dave. But I will say this. If you are a sports radio fan living in the Sacramento area, very good chance you have heard of Carmichael Dave. He has been covering mixed martial arts, but also all kinds of sports for a very long time over in Sactown. In fact, he was largely responsible for keeping the Sacramento Kings around. He played a huge part in all of that, but he's also known Uriah Faber for pretty much longer than anyone in the media. And so I wanted to talk to him about Faber's return this Saturday at the UFC Sacramento card and what Faber means to the city. I've covered a lot of Faber fights in Sacramento, and it's always a very special thing. And so I thought he would provide the best insight possible. So I'm looking forward to talking to him later on in the program, a legend of the Sacramento sports scene. We'll also talk to New York Rick in a little bit as well about some other news and notes. But first, I do believe we are going to be joined by my old pal, Mark Raimondi of ESPN, who is kind enough to take some time out of his schedule and carve us a little cameo over here. Mark, are you there?
I'm here.
Hello, Mark.
How are you?
I'm doing great, Mark.
Are you okay?
Got into a little fender bender. You heard about this?
I heard.
How did you hear?
Breaking news. Well, you know, I got my sources there.
Wow. The streets are talking.
You all right?
Well, you know what happened? It's a lesson for everyone. I'm driving in, coming to the studio, and I scheduled a radio interview during the drive, you know, give me something to do. They call me, take my AirPods out, put them in my ear, and in the midst of that, got into the fender. Am I incriminating myself by saying this? I don't know, but I fully owned up to it, and I must say the other person in the car was very lovely and understanding. But yeah, there's a lesson there. Focus, don't do anything else, and if you have to take a call, have the AirPods in or use Bluetooth or something.
No injuries. Everyone's
no injuries.
Safe.
Yeah, no injuries. So
any damage?
Oh, yes. Plenty.
Damage, yeah?
Yes, of course.
Oh, no. Bad?
I'd say it's like a 6 out of 10 on the bad scale. Why do you have to remind me of this, Mark? I'm trying to forget about it and talk some MMA with you over here, okay? Let's not harp on this.
Sorry, you know me. I have a lot of questions.
Yeah, you do. Always negative there, Mark. All right, let's talk some MMA. And I want to talk about a phenomenon that I find so fascinating right off the top. I mean, I'm not necessarily going in chronological order here or order of importance, but I think it fits on this particular show. It's the phenomenon that we've seen. I was just thinking about like when I first noticed it. I first noticed it after Chael Sonnen lost to Anderson Silva at UFC 117. And of course, I've noticed it afterwards, and I've talked about it a lot. I've highlighted it, not just me, others have, including you. This phenomenon that a heartbreaking loss in MMA is not a death sentence to your career. And we saw it with Conor McGregor when he lost to Nate Diaz at 196. We saw it with Dominic Cruz when he lost to Cody Garbrandt. We saw it Daniel Cormier when he lost to Jon Jones. We've seen it with a bunch of fighters that if you do not hide, if you do not shy away from the loss, if you actually show up to the press conference, you talk about it, you face the music, you don't offer excuses. In a weird way, you end up becoming more popular than you were. And here I am on this Wednesday talking to you. You know, we were talking last week about Masvidal Askren. A week later, do you agree with me that Ben Askren is actually more popular today than he was this time last week going into that fight because of how he is handling this loss. It seems like everyone is rallying around him. Everyone is pulling for him. They want to see him come back. They want to see this reclamation project. He's a little more human now. He's a little more likable because he suffered the setback. It's an amazing thing that we don't often see in other sports.
I agree. I think that Ben Askren could not have handled that any better. I mean, that is about as devastating a loss as you can get, and it may not be as high profile as a Ronda Rousey losing to Holly Holm by a head kick in a huge stadium in Melbourne, her only loss, her first loss. But 5 seconds, man. I mean, it's a 5 second knockout. It's the fastest knockout in UFC history. And after talking a whole bunch of crap, and then he was able to come back. And man, that interview on Monday on your show was so great. It was just, he poked fun at himself. It was self-deprecating. It was everything that you want to see in an athlete who suffers a loss. And I think you're right. I think that you're onto something. I think that when you show that human side of yourself, I mean, first of all, in mixed martial arts, one loss does not make a fighter by any means. Everyone loses unless you're, John Jones and Khabib Nurmagomedov has not lost yet. But pretty much everyone in the history of the sport has lost at some point. It's not something that you can't overcome. And Ben Askren is, I think, well on his way to doing just that in the eyes of the fans, for sure.
Why does it feel like in mixed martial arts, losses don't mean as much or don't hurt you as much as they do in boxing? When someone loses in boxing, it's like all hell is broken loose. It's a horrible blow to their career. Are they ever going to come back? Are they ever going to rebound, etc.? And in MMA, we see this phenomenon. I don't feel like that phenomenon exists in boxing. Why do you think that is?
I think the way that boxing is set up, the way that it's structured, is if you have a blue chip prospect, someone who could be a star and make money for you as a promoter and for him or herself, there are a lot of showcase fights, I guess. Yeah, a lot of tune-ups, a lot of quote-unquote opponents that get thrown against you until you're 20-0, 25-0. And if you lose against one of those people that you're not supposed to lose to, I mean, it can be a disaster because basically they're being set up to feed you, to build your record. And I think in boxing, like when someone, it's a high profile title fight and it's a huge main event fight on pay-per-view, I think if you lose that fight, it's not as big of a deal. But on the way up, there's a certain expectation. I mean, if you look at the boxing records across the board, look at them. I mean, there are very few top-notch fighters have more than 2-3 losses. Whereas in MMA, I mean, some of the top fighters in history have a number of losses. Some even have in the double digits, and they're still as big as stars as they are now. I think there's a different expectation in MMA. I think especially the UFC, you know you're going to have to take your lumps on the way up. There's almost no such thing as just cutting through the competition like that, whereas in boxing there is.
Is it a crazy statement to make that Ben Askren is more popular than Jorge Masvidal after that fight?
I think he was more popular going in. So I think he is on the way out because I think he was more popular on the way in. But Jorge Masvidal is more popular than he's ever been. I mean, this is a guy. I mean, you know this, Ariel. We've been talking to Jorge Masvidal for many years, and he wasn't as he just didn't get the opportunity to shine like he has now. I mean, he's saying the same type of things now that he always did, right? I mean, this is the same guy. He hasn't changed. It's just a different platform for him. I mean, I've been talking to Masvidal for 5-6 years, and he's been just as hilarious and just as glib and just as profane at times then as he is now. I mean, this guy's been around forever. He lost to Toby Amata by inverted triangle in Bellator.
Yeah.
way back in the day. He fought in Sengoku. I mean, but Askren, yes. I mean, to answer your question, I know I went off on a tangent, but he's more popular, and I don't know if that's because of the way he handled it. That helps, but he was just more popular going in.
Well, I actually think you're onto something with the Masvidal stuff because it is amazing for those who have been watching him or covering him for a long time to see what he has become. Because as you mentioned, he was sort of, he was like the mid-tier guy, tough guy, but he was for the longest time, like the king of the split decision. And it always felt like he was just doing enough in fights. Like he wasn't going for things like, look how he started the Darren Till fight. He kind of started it the same way, except he nailed him in the balls. But here, you know, he nailed the flying knee and like he's going for it. And I was saying this on Monday, and I know some people will roll their eyes at it. I think his manager, Abe Kawa, deserves a lot of credit for this because ever since they linked up, you know, I hate to spoil it for everyone, but Abe runs his social media and his social media can be kind of funny from time to time. And he has sort of, he has, I think, maybe amplified the character that is Gamebred, the character that is the Miami / Cuban fighter who acts the way he does, talks the way he does. And let's be honest, I mean, he's done a lot of the work himself. He's the one who said three-piece in a soda. He's the one who says, you know, MGM Grand Buffet and all that stuff. But together, I think they have made a great team, and he's being put in the right fights and the right situations. And I think his coaching staff deserves a lot of credit for it, too. All of a sudden, here he is. This guy who has been in the sport 16 years, a product of the Kimbo Slice backyard brawls, has fought everyone, has had a litany of split decisions, close fights, fights that he has lost. And now all of a sudden he's like one of the biggest stars in the sport, one of the biggest draws. I was talking to the social media team at ESPN and there's like everything this guy does is gold. It's pretty incredible. And so then I'll ask you this. Should the UFC now call an audible, not give the title shot to Colby Covington if he wins on August 3rd, and ride this horse, capitalize on his stardom? In a million years, I never thought I would ask this question, but now it seems like a legitimate question. Should Masvidal get a title shot regardless of what happens on August 3rd?
Maybe. And let me just add one thing, Ariel. One key ingredient that you did miss, and I think you definitely hit all the right notes, but one thing you missed, the move up in weight. The move up in weight has been enormous for Masvidal. And I think that the reason why he went to so many split decisions is because he just couldn't keep it on the gas pedal at 155 the way he knows he can at 170. I mean, if you look at that Ali Aquinta fight, I mean, that's a great example. I thought he won that fight, honestly, on the judges' scorecards. But that's a fight that, I mean, he obviously could not – he didn't have the cardio in the third round that he did in the first, and it wasn't the same guy. And now it's a different type of Masvidal at 170. It's a whole new guy. And as far as the title shot, I think you have to still wait to see what Colby Covington does against Robbie Lawler in Newark here in a few weeks on August 3rd. I think that, I mean, look, I said this on your show. I mean, and we talked about this. Colby Covington should have had the title shot. He should have. I mean, it should have happened already, and it hasn't for whatever reason. Timing's been against him. You could say maybe the UFC has been against him. I think that if he does beat Robbie Lawler, it's hard to deny him. But you also, it's very hard to deny Masvidal's momentum. There may not be a better time. I feel like they kind of missed out on Colby's momentum last year and earlier this year. He had all the momentum, and Usman got the fight instead of him against Woodley. And now Masvidal has all the momentum. Do you want to waste the momentum again? I mean, it's going to be a tough pill to swallow for Covington, but it's a tough one. There's certainly a hard decision to make. Can we do a triple threat match, Ariel?
Oh, no. No, we can't. Maybe a ladder match, but I'm not sure if triple threat only. I think you need to have the ladder if you're going to do triple threat.
Okay, gotcha.
But I do know that they aren't making any decisions until August 3rd, so they're going to reserve the right to wait. And quite frankly, they have all the time in the world because Usman's not coming back at least until November. So it's not like you have to make that call now. But Colby Covington, like, the heat is on. And it's so fascinating because they're friends, they're teammates, they're former roommates. They've trained together, and now all of a sudden, like, Colby can't just win on August 3rd. A decision win like he did against RDA, as impressive as that was, isn't enough. The same kind of win he had against Damian Maia isn't enough. He has to do something spectacular against Robbie Lawler, and then he has to do something spectacular on the mic, I think, to get people behind him. And the irony is, like, he's kind of the bad guy, right? Like, no one gets behind Colby Covington, though I think he's softened up a little bit over the last few weeks and months. It's very hard to get behind the guy because of his whole shtick. And obviously for the UFC, the easiest thing would be if Robbie Lawler wins. I think if Lawler wins, it's then it's a clear-cut choice to put Masvidal in that spot. But it's going to be super fascinating to see what they do if Covington does something spectacular, if he knocks him out, if he gets a quick sub and then does something on the mic. Because you know how this game goes, recency bias, everyone gets all fired up, and then you forget about Jorge Masvidal. It's a fascinating thing. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, we'll get the title shot, Ariel.
Who?
I think I know who will get it.
Who?
If Covington wins,
yes,
and we know Masvidal wins, and Usman is queued up for whenever he's back from injury, whether that's November or December, it's going to be whoever takes the least amount of money from the UFC to take that welterweight title shot. You and I know this already.
Sure.
They'll pit Masvidal and Covington up against each other.
Yep.
And it'll be whoever gives the UFC the best deal gets the title shot. That's how it'll go.
And after they didn't do...
Tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong. I was just going to say, after they didn't do Woodley against Covington, and after they didn't do Covington-Usman, nothing would surprise me, right? Like, those were two of the most surefire fights that you can come up with. I mean, just great. Like, the fights made themselves. They were just as hot as can be. They didn't make them for whatever reason, politics, timing, whatever. So nothing would surprise me at this point. They're going to do what's best for business and what makes the most sense for them in that moment. Let's take a quick pause on the 239 talk, because the main reason I have you on the show today isn't to talk about all this stuff. It's to talk to you about perhaps my most anticipated fight of 2019. Well, you're onto something there. It is the return, the highly anticipated return of the great Dos Caras Jr. going up, and I don't know why you're laughing, going up against the one and only Huntington Beach bad boy himself, Tito Ortiz, in Combate Americas. This was announced yesterday. Now, do we have a date and location yet? No, right?
We have neither a date nor a location.
Okay.
I am wondering if a commission in the United States will approve this fight.
Oh, of course they will.
I have a feeling they probably would.
Of course they will. Are you kidding? After the gold standard, Nevada sanctioned Conor McGregor 0-0 going up against the 49-0 Floyd Mayweather. Everyone,
right.
Look, let's not forget, as much as we joke, Alberto Del Rio, the former WWE champion, aka Dos Caras Jr., is 9-5 as a professional MMA fighter. Yes, his most notable moment was getting knocked out by Mirko in a fight that was maybe a work shoot. I'm not quite sure, but he was wearing a luchador mask and it was incredible. But can I just say, I love this. I kind of love everything about it. It's perfect for Combate. It's so wacky. Tito Ortiz, Mark, signed with Combate via an iPhone video.
That's right.
Him signing a contract on Campbell McLaren's back. I mean, no fanfare, has done like very little media. I've tried to talk to him since. They won't talk for whatever reason. And now his first fight against Alberto Del Rio, who's been this sort of figurehead promoter guy for Combate, you know, in his early 40s. I mean, the whole thing is so wacky, it actually fits for that promotion. Do you agree?
I mean, it's not the worst thing they could do. I think if they're trying to drum up interest, and let's face it also, I mean, Alberto Del Rio has a lot of, I mean, what are we calling him? Alberto Rodriguez? What are we calling him?
I would like to go with Dos Caras Jr.
Dos Caras Jr., okay, yes. Well, he obviously has, a big following in Mexico and also in the Latin American community in the United States. He was really on at the highest levels of WWE for, like 5 or 6 years. I mean, so he's pretty popular. Tito Ortiz is obviously Tito Ortiz. He's one of the most popular fighters in the history of the UFC. I mean, there are worse things you can do to drum up interest, and I will be interested to see where that fight ends up, if they're going to do it on pay-per-view, if it's going to be on one of the channels that Combate Americas runs on. I know they do very good ratings. It's going to be interesting. We've seen worse in MMA. This is not the most outlandish thing I've ever heard of. Tito Ortiz is 44. Certainly he'll be a huge favorite. Alberto Dos Caras Jr. Del Rio El Patron has not fought since 2010. Although I do hear he is in Mexico City right now training with the wrestling team, the Olympic wrestling team right now in the mountains of Mexico
City. There you go.
That is what I've been told.
We need some footage of that.
He does actually have a legitimate wrestling an amateur wrestling background as well.
We need footage of that. Well, whatever they do, they got to get footage of that. I think a pay-per-view would be a disaster. You can't do this on pay-per-view.
Why not?
I mean, I guess you can if you want six buys.
You know, $14.99, $19.99, something like that. Come on.
I don't know. I think maybe on YouTube or something, or some streaming platform, but to do it on pay-per-view, that would be just brutal. But I will say, all jokes aside, I actually think Tito is the perfect fit for Combate at this point in his career. Obviously he's older. He's not going to fight. younger guys, but he's actually on a winning streak, first of all. Second of all, he is a big star in the, you know, in the Latino market, the Hispanic market, so why not? He can be used as a figurehead. Is there any part of you that is wondering if this is going to be a work? Truthfully.
No.
Okay, you think it'll be 100%?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. What do you think?
Am I naive?
No, I don't know. Listen, I'm always the one who says that everything is legit. Like, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But, you know, I was just talking to Chael about, you know, the Dos Caras Mirko fights and whatnot. And he has his doubts about whether or not they were 100%.
He has his doubts about everything that happened in Pride.
Yes. I don't know. I just kind of like it. I don't know why. I just think it's kind of so wacky. It works.
I mean, it's harmless. I mean, right? It's not. I don't think. I mean, who knows? I don't think Tito Ortiz will do any kind of terrible damage. I mean, I could be wrong. I mean, maybe he will. I don't know. But
will you watch?
Oh yeah, of course. Come on.
You don't seem as jazzed. I'm actually more excited about this than you are. I didn't expect that.
You are, I think it's part of the reason is because we don't have a date yet.
We don't
know where it's going to be yet. It's not quite a real. I know that both sides have agreed to it, but it's not quite a real thing yet. I think that once I know that a commission will approve it, we have a date, we have a card, you know, we have a, you know, we have a venue, and we know where we can watch it. I think I will be a little bit more excited.
By the way, a commission doesn't have to approve it. They could go to a place with no commission.
They could go to Mexico.
Yeah.
They could do it, I guess, on, you know, one of the Native American reservations that don't have sanctioned fights. I mean, yeah.
You could go to Spain. You could go, like, to a bunch of random places.
Yeah. Sure, you could.
So don't get caught up in all this.
I feel like Combate Americas has sought out regulation in most of their fights.
Oh, I'm
most
not.
Their fights have been in California.
Yeah, but some of them have been in like Tijuana, other places in Mexico. So I'm not saying that they're going to.
What are you saying? You don't think Tijuana has?
No,
a
I'm just saying
on the up and up.
No, but I'm just saying they don't have a commission. That's all.
No, they certainly don't.
There's no Mexico commission or Mexican commission or anything like that. So
they do have some kind of a boxing organization down there, though. I'm not really familiar with it, though.
Whatever they do, they need to get one of those shows where Tito and Alberto Del Rio are doing like a face-to-face interview, you know, sort of like the stuff that Kellerman used to do. Brian Campbell does it now. Have them in the same room face-to-face.
Yeah.
One of them has to be sitting in a chair that's facing the opposite way, and they just need to go back and forth.
You know, it's going to all be about politics, though. They've already started this.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Where have they started this?
On social media.
Oh, I have not seen that.
Maybe that's why I'm not so pumped up about it.
Oh, geez. I don't pay attention to any of that. Oh, no. Now you just ruined it for me.
Sorry.
Okay. All right. Well, that's kind of a bummer. Before I let you go, let me ask you, okay, let's go from, you know, two older guys.
I'm really good at throwing cold water on things, Ariel.
Sorry, yeah, clearly. To a younger guy going up against an older guy, announced last night, Crone Gracie against Cub Swanson, reported by ESPN. How do you feel about this matchup? Too soon for Crone? Or the right kind of fight considering the state of Cub Swanson's career?
I like it. I like it a lot, actually. I think that it's a really nice piece of matchmaking. Crone Gracie, even before he fought Caceres, he was saying he wanted someone better, which, I mean, I thought that fight was fine. I thought that was the right type of matchup for Crone in his UFC debut. But to his credit, he was calling for a tougher fight, and he did what he said he would do. I mean, he pretty much ran through Caceres. Cub Swanson is, I think, it's one of those fights where we're going to find out exactly where Crone Gracie is at right now as far as his career. I know it's very early on and he has time to grow, but he seems like obviously on the ground, he's going to be an absolute monster. And we're going to find out, you know, if he's able to do that against someone of the caliber of Cub Swanson. We know who Cub Swanson is. And for Cub Swanson, you know, if you can beat Crone Gracie, you get back on the winning track and you're, you know, you're kind of back with momentum behind you. So I like it. I mean, I think it's one of those fights that whoever wins will find out more about, and there could be bigger things for them in the future.
Yeah, Swanson has lost four in a row, so it's kind of the perfect time to do this kind of matchup. I would also offer that Alex Caceres isn't a scrub. So you already beat him.
Not at all.
Rather convincingly, there isn't that big of a gap between Caceres at this juncture, who's looked okay as of late, and Swanson at this juncture of his career. And yes, he's coming off a split decision loss to Shane Burgos, but maybe it's a little sooner than I thought, but it's not the craziest thing in the world. And they've done this before, and I know that they wanted to do Cron Gracie versus Uriah Faber. That was the talk for Faber's fight, his return fight later this weekend. So, you know, they clearly have high hopes for him. They clearly want to put him in a spot there against, you know, a veteran of the game. And Faber is – I would say Faber at this point is sort of at the same point as Swanson is at this juncture, even though Faber hasn't fought for 2.5 years. So I don't hate it. I kind of like it. I like when they do this, and it's not a contender. It's not a guy who's on a crazy winning streak. It's the safest – youngster versus and Cron isn't, you know, like a baby necessarily, but youngster in his career going up against a veteran. So I agree with you on that. All right, my man, great stuff. I appreciate the time. I'll talk to you later. Thanks for kind of ruining my love for Del Rio versus Tito. I'll now look up those tweets and now totally turn.
And just to go back to where the beginning, you're okay. Everything's good with the accident.
Yeah. Why do you have to ask again? We already went over this.
All right, I'm a little worried about you, and I don't want you to have to, you know, pay through the nose of in this claim.
Wow.
Yeah?
Troy, can you drop that call? Thank you. Bye, Mark. Wow, he went to the nose, huh? First, I get it from Paul Heyman, who said that if I ever had a nosebleed, it would flood Bergen County, and now I have to hear it from Mark. Anyway, Mark loves pro wrestling. I love pro wrestling. My man Peter Rosenberg does a great podcast every week about pro wrestling. So before we get to New York Rick, let me just tell you about my good friends over at the Cheap Heat podcast. They've got a huge wrestling weekend coming up with Evolve being carried by WWE Network, and that's running up against the AEW show as well. A special guest joins Rosenberg and stat guy Greg, and they'll bring you all the wrestling talk you want, unlike anyone else. Who's the special guest? I have no idea. You'll have to find out. All that and more on the Cheap Heat podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. A big Cheap Heat mark is our next guest, New York Rick. He listens every week. Is that not right, Mr. New York Rick?
That's accurate. I'm a big fan. I'm a mark, as you would say.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, you're a mark for Stat Guy Greg, which is weird. Like, you're a mark for the Sunny to the Share.
A tremendous asset to the show.
Wow.
There's nothing weird about that at all.
You've always sort of fancied yourself the Stat Guy Greg to my Peter Rosenberg.
Wow. Well, let's not go there now.
Like, you said it.
It would be Greg. Greg would be the New York Rick to that show versus the other
way
around.
Fair enough.
Let's not get it twisted.
All right. Fair enough.
I'm the OG over here, but yes, big fan.
All right. Okay, let's go back to UFC 239. I talked about Masvidal Askren with Mark at length, but I want to ask you about John Jones now, because I'm starting to see this narrative out there that John Jones is slipping, that he's vulnerable, that he's ripe for the taking, that the next guy could be the one to finally beat him. Are you getting that now? Now we have a pretty good sample size. We have three fights. We have the win over Gustafsson. We have the win over Anthony Smith, and now his first split decision victory over Thiago Santos this past weekend. Are you starting to feel like John Jones is slipping?
I'm wondering if that is people trying to will it into existence or truly basing that on what's in front of us. So John Jones, I'm looking at, looks just as dangerous as ever, just as complete as ever, just as able to stick to a winning game plan as ever. I'm not buying that line of thinking. I don't see vulnerability in John Jones. And until I do, I'm not ready to pick anybody against John Jones.
Okay, so of the people out there right now, of the options, because it did seem like Luke Rockhold was being groomed to be that next guy. Of course, he loses to Jan Błachowicz. There seems to be maybe one or two options for him because he wants to return in December. He's made that clear. There's a pay-per-view December 14th in Las Vegas. Dominic Reyes, undefeated in the UFC, or Jan, who had the big win over Rockhold, the big knockout. Do you like any of those options for John next?
I like them only because I imagine and assume that we're not going to get Daniel Cormier versus John Jones on that advanced timeline. That's the only reason I'm okay with either of those options. There doesn't seem to be much else out there. But for me, the fight is Cormier and pretty much nothing else. I don't think Dominic Reyes or Jan have essentially, you know, made me say I have to see that fight. So I'd be okay with those fights just because they're the next contender up. And, you know, love him or hate him, John Jones throughout his career has always taken on, you know, the contenders and taken on all comers to defend his belt. But the only fight I really care about, the only fight I'd be invested in, is Daniel Cormier versus John Jones.
Even if Cormier loses on August 17th?
Doesn't affect it one way or the other to me.
Whoa.
Let's think about it. He has two losses to John Jones. Let's discount, you know, a potential loss to Stipe Miocic. He already has two losses to John Jones. That would be the bigger disqualifier if we're thinking about this objectively. But the fact that there's so much heat between the two, the fact that Daniel Cormier, I think, is one of the best pound-for-pound fighters on the planet, and John Jones is the best pound-for-pound fighter on the planet for my money, that is the fight I'd care about. That is the fight I'd be able to get behind and put energy into. Anything else is just another title defense for John Jones.
Okay, so would it be a 205 or heavyweight?
I would rather see it at heavyweight because I think Daniel Cormier would be better there, and I think that would bridge the gap a little bit. I think that would even the odds a little bit, but I don't think that John Jones is interested in that fight at heavyweight. I think, you know, he's spoken pretty frankly about the idea of not giving Daniel Cormier any advantages, him having, you know, two wins over him, him being the light heavyweight champion. Cormier would have to come down if he wanted that fight. I would rather see it at heavyweight, but I don't anticipate that fight happening at heavyweight.
Do you subscribe to the notion, New York Rick, that the pressure is now on John Jones, that we've seen other champions like Henry Cejudo, like Amanda Nunes, take the challenge very recently and step up, go for another title? And John has always stayed at 205, and he's flirted a couple times, but never really seriously. And it seems like the options are limited. And again, I'm not changing my stance here. 205 is more interesting than ever, but I think the majority of those youngsters slash contenders can afford maybe one or two before fighting someone like John Jones. And that even includes Dominic Reyes, who, in my opinion, if we're going to go with the 205er, it has to be him. But, you know, maybe one more can get people a little more jazzed up about him fighting John Jones. And so do you think that the pressure is now on for him to step up and fight the winner of DC Miocic, or any heavyweight for that matter, sort of like what Anderson Silva did when he fought James Irvin, you know, a mid-tier heavyweight just to test the waters, because everyone else is doing it, it seems?
I don't think the pressure is on him, because I think the difference in a lot of these scenarios is that he's the A side of this equation. Any fight that he's in, if he goes up to heavyweight, if he stays at light heavyweight, he's the A side. He's in control of this narrative. So I think it's on his pace, it's at his leisure when he decides where to go. But I also think, you know, the money fights are at heavyweight for him. I don't think that Dominic Reyes or Jan Błachowicz is a money fight for him. I think those are just title defenses. And so if he wanted to go up to fight, let's say, a Stipe Miocic or a Daniel Cormier, that would be a bigger draw. That would be a money fight. But I don't necessarily think that there's pressure on him, and I don't necessarily think that he's one to succumb to that pressure. I think it's really him getting himself ready and choosing that right moment to go to heavyweight, because honestly, he's in control of how that plays out.
I agree with you that that's the best fight. It's the biggest fight. It's the most lucrative fight. I don't have as much interest in seeing that fight at 205 as I do at heavyweight. At heavyweight, it's my most anticipated fight. And I remember us sitting New Year's Eve on the show, you picking it, I picked it. But at 205, I've seen it. There's nothing interesting there. I get why DC wants it at 205. At heavyweight, I'm all in. At heavyweight, it's for new stakes. It's a different set of circumstances. It's DC at a more natural way. I'm all in on that. And it's also the question of how does John perform as a heavyweight. So I love that at heavyweight. No interest at 205.
I'm still interested. You can still get me at 205. And quite frankly, I think both the competitors in this case are more interested in that 205.
Oh,
205.
They've both
John
said.
Certainly is, and Cormier certainly is. So they've still got me. They still got me hooked.
They both said it. Yeah, they both said they only wanted a 205, or I guess if the UFC pays them a lot of money. But even DC, I wonder if they throw the world at him. I still think he really wants it at 205, which is just absolutely fascinating. How about Thiago Santos? Can we just talk about Thiago Santos for a second? I thought he deserved a little more credit going into this fight because of how hard he hits, and I think he hit John with everything. And I actually left that fight. Like, I still don't get why people didn't enjoy that fight. I thought it was very dramatic. I thought it was very interesting. He was hitting him with some unbelievable punches. I mean, they hurt just watching them. And John didn't flinch. I mean, John has a chin.
Yeah.
John has a very impressive chin. He could take a punch. And Santos kept coming. And I thought it was a little bit much that they kept talking about the ACL at the time. I was like, how do you guys know it's an ACL? Well, I guess they do know, and I'm dumb, because apparently not only did he tear his ACL, he tore everything else as well. It's a pretty amazing performance. At some point, I would like to see it again. I think he deserves that. And I'm not usually one of those people who thinks that the contender who lost in the title fight to the long-standing champion deserves another rematch, or another fight, I should say. In this case, because it was so close, because one judge, you know, even had it for Thiago Santos, because you can debate that second round all day long, I actually would like to see the rematch at some point.
Yeah, I didn't think Thiago Santos won that fight. But what I do think is that he was dangerous in that fight. There were opportunities for him to win that fight. He was fighting on a compromised leg and still had an incredible performance. Unlike, let's say, you know, the Anthony Smith fight against John Jones, it didn't seem like at any point John Jones was in danger there, right? There was no chance of him losing that fight. He was on cruise control. He took it from start to finish. Thiago Santos, you know, he's a flawed fighter, certainly. But, you know, he's not like John Jones in that there's no holes in his game. But what you can guarantee with Thiago Santos is that he's going to be dangerous and that he's going to put himself in position to land those punches. Sometimes it works against him. His run at middleweight, you know, there were opportunities where he was trying to finish a fight and got finished himself, and that's going to happen when you're a power puncher like he is. But it's one thing to say somebody has a puncher's chance, and it's another thing for him to actually put himself in position to land those punches. And credit, as you said, is due to John Jones, who still has a beard and can still take that chin. Who can still take those punches on the chin with little effect. So it's going to be very difficult for somebody to figure out how to beat John Jones, but I definitely think Thiago Santos gave it one of the better efforts we've seen.
And what about your boy Israel Adesanya? Unbelievable. The back and forth between him and John is slowly, not quite there yet. Don't mistake what I'm saying, but slowly starting to rival DC Jones, right? It's slowly starting to get there.
If you go back to it, if you actually think about how that fight kind of came together, DC Jones was all based on this one Las Vegas, like, curbside.
It actually started UFC 121. Remember UFC 121?
Yeah, that's right.
When he walked up to him and said, oh, you're the Olympian, I could take you down.
Yeah, that was the you know, street exchange that they had that then turned into something. It seems like we're getting the makings of a good John Jones rivalry here with Israel Adesanya. The problem is Israel Adesanya just captured the middleweight title. Like, he burst onto the scene, you know, a little over a year ago. This isn't somebody who's kind of been dominating at middleweight for a long time. I think there's still plenty of fights for him to have at middleweight. I still think there's a lot for him to prove at middleweight. So I wouldn't want him to rush into a fight with John Jones, but certainly I think down the line, Israel Adesanya versus John Jones is one of the biggest fights we can make.
Oh, I love the back and forth between them, and I love how personal it's getting, and I love the kind of trash talk and the banter and the disdain. And I think it was Tatiana Suarez on Instagram who actually just posted a video on her story of, I didn't see this on the broadcast, I don't know if you did, Stylebender was right there when Jones was getting all checked out before going into the cage. Did you see this? Like, while he was getting
Vaseline?
He's literally standing right in front of him, watching him. And there's a guy who gets in his way, and he tells the guy to get out of the way. I don't know if he wanted to be on camera or if he wanted Jones to see him, but it's very amazing footage. Like she captured it perfectly, and I don't think anyone else saw it. And I don't know why she posted it like 4 days later, but it's great stuff. If you follow Suarez or not, go to her Instagram and check it out in the next 24 hours, because he's right there in his face. It's amazing. I love everything about it. At some point, I would love to see that fight. It feels like it could even be one of those fights that we'll never see, just because of, as you just mentioned, he just started his run at 185. But we know how the UFC is. If there is a fight to be made, and one that would obviously bring in a lot of money, I shouldn't say that, because we had the Covington and Woodley fights and the Covington-Usman fights, and they just kind of sneezed at those. But you get my point. It's something that should be done. Now, let me ask you about Luke Rockhold for a second here while we're talking about 205. I didn't see this coming. I did not see this fall from grace coming for Luke Rockhold. And I don't want to ask you if he should retire. That's not our place. He did suffer a broken jaw. It was his third knockout, and very bad knockout once again in his last four fights. Are you shocked by this? Like, I am. I thought Luke Rockhold will go down as one of the best champions at 185 of all time. And now he moves up to 205, and I thought he looked so good all week in Las Vegas and appeared to be in good spirits, and I thought Jan was the perfect opponent for him, and then he gets brutally knocked out. I did not see this coming.
I would say I think it's a disservice to his opponents to say, you know, that this is all, you know, Luke Rockhold's fall from grace, because I think that the level of competition that he's facing is very, very high. Being a former champion, you don't get those cupcakes. You don't get those layups. So if you're going to have a decline, if you're going to have a fall from grace, it's often going to be steep because you're just fighting these names and this level of competition that is hard to avoid. And at the same time, I would say that I think Luke Rockhold's best part of his game is his grappling, not his striking. And in the later part of his career, he's turned into a striker. You know, he's been working very diligently with Henry Hooft and turning himself into a better striker. And I think he has successfully done that. But I do think there's some defensive deficiencies that people have been able to expose. And the result of that is, you know, a string of losses. But I do think if, you know, as a fighter, as a grappler, he's elite. And I think if he can take fights to the ground, he's still going to be very, very dangerous and actually be able to turn this around. But I think it's going to be a stylistic thing much more so than, you know, Luke shot or not shot. I still think he's very game. I still think he's, you know, somebody who's going to be a tough out for a lot of guys. But he needs to return to a little bit of that grappling game that was so successful. I think, and even in the fights where, you know, he was finishing those fights with grappling, oftentimes it would be him either rocking somebody or getting rocked and then turning it into a grappling match from there and finishing it. I think he should come with that style a little more aggressively on the offensive side and you know, not be standing on the feet where he can be exposed.
Wow. Okay. So a little more of a positive take from Yurik Rick than everyone else who's calling for him to retire.
I don't think it's over for Luke Rockhold. That's how I'll put it.
All right. So this weekend we have Jermaine Durandamy going up against Aspen Ladd. In a couple of weeks, we have your girl, Felicia Spencer, going up against Chris Cyborg. Of those four, who's going to fight Amanda Nunes next?
Oh, boy. That's a great question. Who's going to fight Amanda Nunes next? I think Cyborg will fight Amanda Nunes next if the contract situation gets sorted out, because I think that's the biggest factor in all of this. Cyborg is the biggest name, the biggest fight. I think there is an interest and an appetite in that rematch, but this fight is the last fight on our contract, so that will be pending that. So let's say Cyborg if the contract thing sorts out. If not, then I'm guessing it's going to be the winner of Ladd and Durandamy. I don't think that Amanda Nunes has much interest in 145 outside of fights with Cyborg, and I don't think that there's much in that division outside of fights with Cyborg. Should Felicia Spencer have a star-making performance, that probably puts her in a good position, but I do think Amanda Nunes is much more interested in defending the 135-pound title, so I would say the winner of Ladd and Durandamy.
See, I disagree with that last statement. I actually think she's made it pretty clear that she wants to defend both, and I think she wants the Cyborg rematch, but you're 100% right. If Cyborg doesn't sign, it's a moot point, and it doesn't seem like things are great right now, but crazier things have happened. I want to ask you this. Let's exclude Cyborg because she's the vet and she's been around the longest, and I think you'll pick Cyborg if I ask you this question, including her. Between Ladd Durandamy, who, let's not forget, Durandamy's last loss was to Amanda Nunes back in 2013. I was there at the Fight for the Troops event. Between Ladd Durandamy and Felicia Spencer, who has the best chance to beat Amanda Nunes, in your opinion?
Oh, boy. That's a great question. I would say probably Durandamy, just based on the experience, based on having been in there and being the veteran of the bunch. I think, you know, Felicia Spencer was fighting an Invicta one fight ago and just made her UFC debut successfully in spectacular fashion with a win over Megan Anderson. Don't get me wrong. And I think she's great. It's no secret that I think she's one of the more talented prospects in MMA. But I think that's way too early. And I think it's too early for Aspen Ladd as well. Aspen Ladd, for my money, one of the best fighters, you know, under 25, around 25, in the world, but I still think it's a little too early for her to be challenging a dominant champion like Nunes. So I'm going to go Durandamy just based on experience. And also I think she presents some difficulties on the feet. You know, she's not going to get overwhelmed by the strike. She's an incredible striker. So my answer is Durandamy.
Wow. Okay. I thought you were going to go with Aspen Ladd, and my answer would be Aspen Ladd, by the way.
She's fantastic. Don't get me wrong, but I think it's early. I just think it's too early.
Really? Even if she beats Durandamy?
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, the last fight was Sajara Eubanks, who's a great fighter, but, you know, has spent some time at flyweight. She's not, you know, she's not the upper echelon of 135. She's, you know, she's somewhere in the mix, but she's not that top tier. And now we're looking at a fight against Durandamy, who, you know, has been out for a bit. Who knows what the, you know, who knows what this win actually means? It's hard to put it into context. I'd like to see her against, you know, some of the very, very top tier of 135, like, let's say, a Holly Holm or somebody who's, you know, been at the top for a long time, to really get a gauge on where she is. To me, I'm not sure. I'm just not sure. I can't say she's not ready for it, but I don't think, I haven't seen that she's ready for it, and I need to see her against a top contender to prove that.
Fair enough. Yeah, she is only 24 years young. She's only 8-0 in the UFC, or in her professional career, she's 4-0 in the UFC. Excuse me, 3-0. Win on Saturday would make it 4-0 for her. But those two wins, in particular against Evinger and Lena Landsberg, who I'll admit aren't quite on the level of Amanda Nunes, or I shouldn't even say quite. I mean, they aren't on the level, period.
Yeah.
Still, I feel like she... I feel like if she wins, she'll, I mean, there's no one else for her to fight other than the champion, but it'll be interesting. I think they'll have to wait and see what happens with Chris Cyborg and Felicia Spencer. I think if Cyborg wins and walks away and Ladd wins, or if Cyborg loses, they'll maybe go with Ladd. I don't know. I guess it depends on how Felicia Spencer wins. It's going to be interesting. And I like the fact that it's all happening so close to each other, so we can kind of figure this out sooner than later. And it seems like Nunes didn't get hurt on Saturday night, so she seems pretty ready to get back in there. All right, New York Rick, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, there he is, the one and only New York Rick. Also of note, this past week, John Lineker, by the way, signing with ONE Championship. Little surprised, thought he would maybe go to Ryzen or Bellator, but ONE seems to be a good place for him after he was released from the UFC, because they're not very strict with the weight cutting stuff. They like people to fight a weight class above. It's all kind of hush-hush over there. So there's an opportunity for him, and also an opportunity for him to potentially fight Demetrius Johnson at 135. So I think that would be interesting as well. But I really wanted to see John Lineker go up against Kyoji Horiguchi, whether it was in Bellator or Ryzen. Unfortunately, for now, it doesn't look like that is going to happen. All right, so let's stick with the Sacramento theme here. And as I told you at the top, I am so excited to talk to our next guest, because he is a legend of the Sacramento sports scene. In fact, I have known this man since the beginning of my career. He's always been very kind to me, and ever since I've been covering events in Sactown or in the, you know, the California region, West Coast, He was there every single time, and he was always very close to the Team Alpha Male squad, and in particular, ONE Uriah Faber. So with Uriah Faber returning, coming out of retirement this Saturday in Sacramento after a 2.5-year hiatus, I thought it would be the perfect time to say hello to ONE Carmichael Dave. He is the host of The Drive on KHTK Sports 1140 in Sacramento, 6 to 9 a.m. Pacific time. He is a legend. Like I said, a living legend. He single-handedly saved the Sacramento Kings. They tried to move him out. He said, hell no. You're not going to do that on my watch. He did it himself. I wish I had those kind of cojones to keep the Expos around. He did it. Amazing. Let's say hello to ONE Carmichael Dave, a.k.a. Dave. Should I not say your last name, Dave? Would you prefer if I don't?
Whatever you want. You're the legend. Are you kidding me? What an introduction. We've known each other a long time, buddy, and every time I see you collect it, they should just name it, honestly. Let's just be honest. Name it the Ariel Helwani MMA Reporter of the Year Award, because it's not going anywhere else until you got a long gray beard and you're living on a mountain somewhere.
I appreciate that, and I really appreciate you doing this, because Dave is on vacation right now and enjoying some time. I see on your social media you're enjoying a great time, and you were kind enough to do this for us, so thank you very much. I'm going to try not to take up too much of your time, but this is just the perfect time to talk to you, because you know that scene better than anyone, and you know Faber better than anyone. So let's start here. When did you first meet Uriah Faber?
Oh, he was in second grade.
Wow.
I was in fourth. He was actually my younger sister, Lindsay, who has grown up to be a big-time Hollywood producer. There's a humble brag for you. He was her first, quote-unquote, boyfriend in second grade. I think the story is they went on a hot air balloon. So he was tooling around my house, my parents' house, I should say, back then, for birthday parties and all that. And then we, you know, our families knew each other a bit. We drifted apart, you know, different schools and stuff. And then it's funny, he got into MMA out of wrestling, UC Davis, right around the time, almost the exact time I got into radio. And so you'll remember, you're one of the few people I can talk to about this. This is back in a time when it was back in human, the radio scene. There was no mainstream coverage at all. I mean, we're talking way back when. So that was back in the day when, you know, I was doing a 9 to midnight show on KHTK, where I'm still at, but do mornings now. And we no joke, Dana White would be calling, or whoever his person was at the time. I want to say it was Lauren Woods, if I remember right, was his guy.
Lauren Mack.
Lauren Woods was the player out of Arizona, excuse me, NBA player. Lauren Mack, thank you. And Lauren would call us, hey, Dana's in town with a couple of fighters. And one I remember very specifically, my producer gets a knock on the back door of our studio at like 9:45 at night. And in comes Dana with Tito Ortiz and Chuck Liddell. And another time it's him and Randy Couture. They're begging for, not begging, but, you know, they're trying to get any mainstream airtime they can. So you remember that time. It was the very beginning of mainstream MMA coverage here in the States. And Uriah kind of did his thing, and I did my thing. And, yeah, it goes beyond just covering him. Obviously, he's a very special part of the Sacramento community and a dear friend of mine. And, you know, he's out of retirement now, so we're all very much – I'm not – as it says on my Twitter bio, Ariel, I'm very biased in this case. There's no journalism going on here. I'm very much rooting for him this Saturday.
I appreciate that very much. What is your earliest memory of – like when you say, oh, he dated my sister, he's second grade – I mean, like, that's just classic Uriah, right? I mean, he's just such a good-looking guy. The ladies love him. My mom loved him. She adored him. He was her favorite fighter, and she's very excited that he's back as well. But, like, Uriah in school back then as a little kid, troublemaker, like, what are your earliest memories of him?
He was a good kid. He still had the little dimple on his chin. It was just less pronounced. It was so many years ago, but I'm guessing right around the same size he is now. We used to, we had a two-story house, and we had a big, giant red pillow that was bigger than all of his kids. We put it on the tile floor outside my bedroom window, and we would take turns. I had a little window that opened up to the interior of the house, and we would jump out of the window onto this big red pillow, which was extremely dangerous, but we did it anyways. We had a little pool, so, you know, he's probably rolling around a blow-up dragon somewhere. It's a good family. He's a good kid, and probably not a lot of people know this. So for those of you listening right now, you want to have a little bit of fun. Go to YouTube when you're done, of course, listening to Ariel's fine program. Go to YouTube and search KZAP, that's KZAP, KZAP Uriah Faber commercial. And Ariel, you might have seen this. If not, I'll text you the link. You can put it out. It's a commercial for a local radio station, a rock station that ceased to exist about 20 years ago. And I want to say it was a 7-year-old Uriah sitting on his mom's lap, I think, at one point, talking about how much he loves the rock station. He was always an actor. He was always a performer. And that's why, I mean, you and I both know that he does and will continue to have a tremendous career outside of the octagon when he's involved.
So were you close? And by the way, I do remember that commercial. I think it surfaced on the UG a few years ago, and it's amazing. It's like a mini version of him. He's so cute.
Yep.
Delivers the lines perfectly. Did you stay in touch with him throughout his wrestling, you know, his collegiate wrestling career and then the MMA career as well? Or did you later on say, like, oh, my God, there's Uriah doing his thing? Because, you know, I know he started to become a legend in your neck of the woods. Were you close with him throughout, or you linked up with him afterwards?
We drifted apart, so I'm about 2 years older than he is. And so throughout junior high and high school, you know, and again, he was in my sister's class. He was my best friend still to this day, Brett. His younger brother, Chris, was one of your good friends at elementary school. So he was kind of your, I was in like the, and you know how it is when you're younger. If you're, nowadays, I've got tons of friends that are younger than me, but back in elementary school, if the kid's 2 years younger than you, he's a little nerd, leave him alone, you can't hang out with him type of thing. Like, he was always in the younger crowd. We drifted apart through nothing other than just doing our own lives. And then again, you know, when he started popping up on these, you know, King of the Cage cards, I remember going and seeing him. Gosh, it was, I think it was a Canoctai Harbor. And that's something only Northern California people will remember. It's about 3 hours outside Sacramento, in the middle of nowhere. and it was an outdoor cage. I'm pretty sure Ariel was in the middle of a parking lot, and it was one of those old school, you know, just roll in there out of a shed, music playing off of a portable speaker, get in the ring, and then just throw down. So it was kind of a mutually beneficial thing. First, it was great to see each other again, but also, you know, I would have him on at a time when he was still, I believe at the time, bussing tables at Cafe Bernardo downtown, in addition to teaching wrestling on the side and doing his own fight. So he was starting out the business. I was starting out the business. And we both just kind of followed each other's careers, obviously me more than him, because, as you know, he's, you know, international superstar now. And really, truly, I had the benefit of knowing him and knowing his family, and it's a wonderful family he has. But he's just done so much. You can't overstate Ariel. You know, there's pockets of MMA throughout the world. And obviously, you know, Brazil, Japan, Florida. But Northern California, where you have, you know, the guy in San Jose, you have Team Alpha Male in Sacramento, you have the Diaz boys down in Stockton, which is not, we have this little triangle. But there's so much talent, and you can't overstate how much Uriah has done, not just for the Joseph Benavidezes, the Chad Mendezes, and, you know, remember, Joseph was coming up from Mexico to Team Alpha Male's gym here and sweeping floors, just trying to do anything to get in. For the longest time, Uriah would take his purse and he'd buy a house. And he had this whole row of houses in my neck of the woods in Carmichael, a little Sacramento suburb, and he would very cheaply, and sometimes I'm pretty sure for free, let up-and-coming fighters stay there. All they do is work out with Uriah, train with Uriah's guys, Master Tong and that whole crew, and then go stay at, you know, Faber's houses. And in fact, I'm up in, it's funny, on top of me right now, you mentioned I was on vacation, I'm up in Mendocino County part of the Northern California coast, and we're in a city called, well, city, we're in this hamlet called Point Arena. Faber, about, God, I want to say 10 years ago, bought this two-story, I don't know what it was, museum, or he'll tell you whatever it was before he bought it, and he's fixed it up into kind of this retreat for fighters a lot of times. It's about a four-hour drive from SAC, and they'll come up here, and he's got mats and a kitchen and bunks and stuff, and they'll stay, and this is one of the most beautiful areas in the world. For example, and I know I'm babbling here, Uriah, but right now it's cloudy. It looks like I'm on, you know, in Nantucket. It's cloudy, foggy. It's about 62 degrees. It won't get up any higher than 65 today. It's going to be 95 in Sacramento. It's gorgeous. And he's always maintained this ability to continually train his guys, not just on fighting, but also on how to handle press, how to handle your money, how to be smart. So, again, I'm babbling, but I can't overstate how important he's been to mixed martial arts here in the area.
No, this insight is amazing, and I'm so happy that you're on. And just listening to you talk, it's great. I'm getting nostalgic for the early days of his career as well. And speaking of which, I want to ask you about WC 34, because I feel like that fight against Jens Pulver, June 1st, 2008, it was a Sunday night. It was on Versus. I feel like that's when I started to figure out, like truly understand how big of a deal he was in Sacramento and in that region. What are your memories? Ultimately, he won that fight and was such a big deal, was billed as one of the biggest, like, lighter weight fights of all time. The legend Pulver coming over from the UFC, you know, 1-0 in WEC, had a great debut against Cub Swanson. And this was a fight that did over a million viewers on Versus. It was just gigantic, especially for a small time promotion. What are your memories of how big of a deal that fight was in Sactown?
You know, as soon as you mentioned the date, I'm not saying this because we're on, this isn't hyperbole. I got chills. I really did. my memories are deep on that, because it was, as you summed it up perfectly, Jens Pulver's a legend and one of the coolest guys in the history of the sport. And you were just, you know, it's very tough for me to verbalize, but Uriah was always our own. We're very, you mentioned the Kings and the team trying to leave. We're very territorial here in Sacramento. We're the little brother of San Francisco, of Los Angeles. We're the forgotten city, even like Tahoe. You know, people don't think of Sacramento. So when something from Sacramento makes it, we become very territorial and protective not because it's a property of ours, but because somebody like Uriah is, he's one of our own, and he, it may say Isla Vista where he was born, he always repped the 916 and the California kid persona to a T. So when he fought Jens, this was really like the coming out party for Faber, and something that people are going to see. In fact, I'm taking my wife and another couple to the fight on Saturday. I'm not working the fight. I'm going as just a pure fan because you never know, but odds are could be the last time we see him. And I know we said that a couple years ago. So you had Jens Pulver announced, music plays, he walks into the octagon, everyone's, you know, the energy is just insane. But Ariel, I've worked in sports radio for over 20 years now, which makes me sound really old. I've covered everything, and obviously there's bias here, I admit it. But when you're in Sacramento, and that was the old Arco Arena, which was renowned for having the roof blown off of it back in the days when the Kings were in the playoffs versus the Lakers. Pulver's in the octagon, the lights go down and pitch black, and then all of a sudden, in the black, in the darkness, you hear the opening, the unmistakable sound of California Love, and then as soon as the beat drops, the lights go on blowing. And I don't know if you remember this, but it was after he had the belt, and one of the coolest things I've ever gotten to do is he let me carry his belt behind him.
Oh, wow.
So there's still pictures. It's hilarious. So I'm carrying the belt behind when he's walking in, and I'm not a religious guy. I'm not overly spiritual, but I can tell you that there is a palpable feeling when you have 18,000 people and a spotlight focused on one maybe 20 square foot piece of land. And when the light came on and shined on Uriah and I'm directly behind him and you're walking out, you can literally feel the energy from everybody in those stands. And it was maybe the most scared I've ever been, because first off, these belts are heavier than people think. Secondly, I'm 6'4", Uriah's 4'3", or whatever he is. Couldn't lock my elbows and hold the belt over my head because it would have been out of the camera shot. You remember Bert, the old guy who used to handle everything with the UFC, is telling me you got to keep your hands at this level. So I'm carrying this belt in a way that's not conducive to my tiny tricep muscles, and I'm following Uriah with cops on either side of us escorting him in and people trying to high-five him and stuff like that. So I'm focusing on the belt, blown away by the energy. And oh, by the way, Faber's rolling out in bare feet, and he doesn't roll in a straight line. He goes forward quick, then he'd stop and kind of shadow box and roll forward again. And we didn't rehearse this, so I'm sitting there. All I'm worried about is one of my big Ophi size 15 feet going to step on his ankle, and I'm going to have the wrath of 18,000 Sacramentans on me. My point is, again, rambling, but you hit my sweet spot here. With that Pulver fight, the California Love intro, and then, of course, the way it turned out, it's just unlike anything I've ever seen in sports. I don't know how the fight's going to go, but I know that I am absolutely an addict. I'm addicted to watching that intro and being a part of that energy, and whatever happens after that happens, but that in itself is worth the price of admission alone.
Wow. I had no idea that you walked out with him. That was an unbelievable story. I got chills all over my body there. That was amazing. You painted that picture beautifully. Did he ask you, how did that happen? Did you ask him? Did he ask you? How'd you get that honor?
He used to come on my show a lot, and we got to talking one night. And he, again, we're on 9 to midnight, so sometimes he would come in studio and just, bring an energy drink, and he'd always have some sort of healthy takeout food that he found somewhere. So he'd sit there with his chopsticks and his blended kale and yams or whatever hippie drink he'd drink. And I think at some point it was like, well, when I win this belt, you gotta carry it out for me. We came from the same spot, and that would be awesome. I said, yeah, sure, no problem. Of course I will, Faber, rolling my eyes. And then it happened, and I remember it was maybe 3 days before the fight, and he texts me. He goes, "Hey, dude, you're still carrying this belt, right?" I thought he was joking. And then we get out there, and there's a whole thing you have to go through. You know, you have to – the California State Athletic Commission must know who you are and what you're doing there, because you're going up to the cage itself. You remember Scott Smith one time. Scott and I had sort of a similar bet where he asked me to be one of his corner men. I basically was holding the spit bucket, but you have to go through a whole process with the fish to do this. So it turned from just this silly little aside between Faber and I into this super official thing. Like I said, you've been cage side at everything. You've seen everything. But to be in that position and like I said, feel the energy through Faber to yourself. I'll send you a picture. It's hilarious where you see me holding the called it some weird angle. I don't know. I've done a lot of cool stuff in my career. You have too, Ariel. I don't know. I'm never going to be able to match.
Oh, that's amazing. What a great story. I'll never forget that night. That's one of the greatest nights in the history of the sport. And I'll also never forget WC 36, because that was his next fight. He beats Pulver and at this point extends his winning streak to 13. I have never seen his loss to Tyson Griffin, but at that point it started to be like, all right, like this guy's never going to lose. Pound for pound, great. The Tyson Griffin thing seemed like a weird anomaly, like that wasn't a real thing. And now he's fighting a guy named Mike Brown on a card that was postponed because there was a hurricane in September. They moved it to November. It's known for two things. Number one, Chael Sonnen beats Paulo Filho, but Filho misses weight, so Chael doesn't get the honor of becoming a champion for the first time in his career, and it ended up being the only chance that he got. And number two, Mike Brown knocks out Uriah Faber, and there's certain moments in this sport where you can't like you will never forget where you were when you saw someone who looked invincible get knocked out, especially in that kind of dramatic fashion. It happened in the first round, 2 minutes and 23 seconds. Mike Brown, who was relatively unknown, knocks him out brutally because of a mistake that Uriah did. Do you remember where you were when he got knocked out?
Yeah, I do. I was sitting with a bunch of our friends having a watch party at my house, and I can tell you that this, what I'm about to say, is something that has been repeated. I will keep saying I can't overstate as a crutch, but I can't overstate what Faber fights, especially in the heyday, meant to the city of Sacramento. These were events. There were entire businesses, bars that would struggle. And you'll remember a lot of those versus, in fact, all those versus fights really were free. Mm-hmm. And these bars would plan event their entire monthly budgets around Faber fights because you didn't want to watch it just by yourself. You know, you wanted to gather with everyone else. And California Love would play in every bar around Sacramento, which was packed. People would just fly out of their seats. In this case, I was at my house, but I was surrounded by a lot of mutual friends, a lot of fans of his, a lot of people that knew him. And we had a funny feeling about it. And certainly I'm not saying we thought he was going to lose, but you'll remember, you mentioned it. This was just a weird event, a weird place, a weird card. Mike Brown was a wild card in itself. Super nice guy. Mike obviously had his own things to deal with. But I remember going through the And you throw out, again, you throw out all journalistic integrity for these things. Every time I ever covered a fight, I always tried to go out of my way to say, guys, there's no bias here. This is when Faber fights and he wins, it's an amazing night. And on that night when he lost, it was just dead silence. It was dead silence. You know, Faber's never really, and I'm knocking on wood here again, he's never had his clock cleaned. Even the Tyson Griffin knockout, the Brazilian that TJ beat.
Hennen Burrell.
He's never you've never seen Faber's eyes roll back into his head. It's always been kind of a cover-up, sort of Herb Dean stoppage type of deal. And you know, whether it was that fight, and I don't know if you were on your way to bring it up, and I'm skipping ahead, but the Jose Aldo,
yes,
which was a monumental moment, and I think really in Faber's obituary, if it's not the first line, it's certainly going to be in the top five. Even in his losses, he was so emotionally drained because you couldn't become so close to these guys. You realize there's a ton of fighters. And I know that's part of the reason you love this sport so much, like me. You understand that the fun part for them is the fight itself, and that this is a game of millimeters. And one false move, and you're done. And who knows when you're getting back. You may get that next title shot in a few months. You may not. Joseph Benavidez is another Team Alpha Male guy, and I remember being in Sacramento when Demetrius Johnson knocked him out. And I was sitting next to his mom and his family at the time and just looking over at them and seeing how crushed they were. And I talked to Joseph that night, and he said something I'll never forget. He said, I would so much rather have my ass kicked for five rounds brutally than have what happened there. I said, what are you talking about? Did you pop? You don't have a mark. Yeah, you might have a slight concussion, I'm sure, a headache in the morning, but why would you possibly want that? I mean, he said, Dave, when I got out, what am I supposed to learn? Dodge the punch? Of course, it's a game of inches. Had he been 2 inches back when Demetrius threw that shot, who knows what would have happened. But because he got left and knocked out, he said, there's no way for me to learn. In Faber's case, he always, I felt, learned from his fights. And even when he was overmatched, he's like Jerry Rice when he played for the Niners. He'd get hit, but he never got hit in his prime to where you thought he seriously got hurt. Faber was always really good at that. And even in his loss to Mike Brown, found a way to kind of keep people on his side and want to rematch.
Yeah, and it's kind of amazing that Mendez retires yesterday officially, and here's Faber coming back, seemingly outlasting all these guys who were supposed to be his protege. It's an incredible thing. But am I crazy, or did you film that video of Faber the day after the loss to Aldo and showed off his leg, how bruised it was? Was that you, or was it someone else?
You are crazy, but I did, in fact, film that.
Okay.
So those are two separate questions. Went over to his house the day after. And again, type of guy he is. He and I had said beforehand, hey, I'm going to come over the next day, regardless of that. He had every right. In fact, I'm kind of sheepishly texting him and saying, hey, dude, I know we had this interview scheduled today, but I totally get it because we were worried for his safety. We really were. He's one of the most brutal poundings I've ever seen somebody take in person. And the he showed, which is one of many reasons I think he endeared himself so much to so many fans against Aldo, where he was never truly in that fight. Aldo, as you remember, was basically taking baseball bats to his legs. Going over the next day, you'll remember from the video, and you guys can search it online again. It looked like somebody had poured a melted bag of Skittles on his thighs. He was on crutches. But he didn't really, and he had such a good attitude about the whole thing. He wasn't hanging his head. He said, I got my ass kicked, and I wasn't, you know, this guy was better than me on that day. I've never seen him down. I've never seen him in a favor, in a bad mood. And Ariel, I promise you, I've been around him enough when the lights are off and when it's just him or him and a couple buddies. Sure, he gets pissed about a thing here or there or frustrated or whatever. I've never seen the guy in a bad mood. And it's amazing to me because he's had plenty of hurdles in his life. But I think the dude just has an outlook that, hey, I've gotten rich and I've seen the world off of using my hands. And the fact that he came from a family that didn't have a ton of money. He was literally used like a commune, you know, as a hippie. I mean, the guy's never had McDonald's in his life, which is crazy. He's very aware from a, you know, you have the macro and micro outlooks on life. His macro is that I've got a blessed life, and I think going into Saturday, he wants to kick this guy's ass. If he wants it to go, in every interview he does.
I may have lost Dave there at the very end. Dave, you still hear me?
Yeah, I'm sorry. There we go. We had it for a while. Can you hear me? Okay?
Yeah, it was kind of getting a little worse during that answer, but we got the general gist. And I've taken up way too much of your time anyway. I promised 20 minutes. I think I've gone 40 with you here, so I'm going to let you go. This has been such a great pleasure. Honestly, just to listen to your stories, it's brought me back to the early days of my career, of WEC, of those Northern California, like when MMA was really special for a lot of us, when it wasn't what it is today. Not to suggest that it's in a bad place today, but it certainly had a different feel. And those were fun times, and Faber was at the forefront of it all, and so were you. So Congratulations on a great career. Congrats on keeping the Kings, because I'm going to give you all the credit for that. You're the ones who kept them in Sacktown. You do a phenomenal job for KHTK Sports, 1140, 6 to 9 a.m. Pacific, every single day. Not this week, you're on vacation, but typically it's always great when I'm on the show. I always appreciate you having me on and everything that you've done for me. Again, thank you for doing this during your vacation, and enjoy the fight this Saturday, and try not to be too stressed about it, because just seeing him back, the walkout, the music, all that stuff, it's going to be a treat for everyone in Sacramento.
I hope the reception doesn't bust out here, Ariel, because right back at you, there's nobody else that I'm out here with the family hanging out. But when Ariel Helwani calls, it's not just not work, it's fun. You and I don't get to talk enough, and you're so busy and so so all over the place. But there's a brotherhood, and not just with guys, a brotherhood, a sisterhood, whatever you want to call it. Back in the days of like Lauren Mack, of Dana, back when Dana was, Dana of old, and almost like a traveling circus. You pick up, you go to a different city, you're trying to sell this sports sponsors, advertisers, you're trying to break it into the mainstream media. And nowadays it's great, and I'm in love with the sport to this day, but it's different. It's corporate. There's billions of dollars everywhere. There's people trying to make a name for themselves. I feel like there's so much more anger amongst the media and amongst people that used to be so accessible, that it's very corporate now, and that's fine, and that's the way it should be, and that's how a sport grows. But guys like you, and there aren't many guys like you, so I should say guy like you, who I remember when you started out too, buddy, and I see you collect your awards every year, and I'm so damn proud of you, because you kept your integrity throughout. I was so damn proud of you through the whole dust up with the UFC a few years ago, and how you held your ground. And we all continue to root for you and admire you, and just keep kicking ass and being an awesome ambassador for the sport.
Thanks so much, Dave. I'll talk to you soon. Appreciate you doing this.
Okay, brother.
All right, there he is, the one and only Carmichael Dave. Such great stories about Uriah Faber. I could have talked to him for an hour there, even with the questionable connection. It was great to have him on. I'm looking forward to Uriah's return this Saturday. Before we end the show, I want to tell you about the UFC Ultimate Fan Experience. Now is your last chance to bid on this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This experience gives you and a guest the chance to receive 4 VIP tickets to attend UFC 245, on December 14th in Las Vegas. Attend a private meet and greet with Dana White. Receive 2 VIP stage passes for the weigh-in for that event, meet and greet and autograph session with fighters backstage, backstage pass and VIP tour of the production, including a tour of the production truck and ring access before the fight. You can get a VIP tour of the UFC headquarters, receive a UFC gym membership for 1 year, receive an ESPN Plus subscription for 1 year, and receive a pair of signed gloves from one of the main event fighters. All you have to do is visit ebay.com/ESPN. That's ebay.com/ESPN to bid on this experience. But hurry up. The auction ends at 6 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday, which happens to be the night this podcast gets released, like just in a couple hours. So Troy better get this up quickly. And he's probably wishing that Carmichael Dave and I would shut up already. All proceeds benefit the V Foundation for Cancer Research. In the fight against cancer, we'll never give up. There you go. ebay.com/ESPN. UFC back in Sacktown. There's also Bellator and one, a lot going on this weekend. Nice little card on ESPN Plus. Jermaine Duranemi against Aspen Ladd. Uriah Faber against Ricky Simone. Josh Emmett against Mirsad Bektik. Some of the fights on the main card, but also the prelims, some good names as well. Andre Tucci-Feely. How about the return of Juliana Pena, who's now a mom, going up against Nico Montano, who we haven't seen in forever. How about Darren Elkins going up against Ryan Hall? I'm looking forward to that. So some interesting names there on the card, and we will talk about that and how Faber's return went and probably a whole bunch of other things next week on the program. But for now, we are out of time. Thank you very much to all of you who continue to download and rate and subscribe and all those good things as far as this podcast is concerned. I love doing it, and I appreciate you doing it so that we can keep on doing it. Thank you very much. Thank you to our guests this week, Mark Raimondi of ESPN, New York Rick, also of ESPN, and the great Carmichael Dave of KHTK 1140 Sports. Tremendous insight from all of them. All right, we're out of time. Again, thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the fights. I'll talk to you next week.